This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Rhonda Copeland as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series.
We'll talk with a consumer watchdog to tell you about the insurance industry's campaign to put devices in your car that will track your every move.
The question is, will there be anything in our life that remains private? Get cheaper insurance, but let the government, or at least let the insurance company for now, know every place you travel to.
As a final parting gift to the environment and to us, the Bush administration is unleashing another assault on the Endangered Species Act.
Big business has never liked being held up by the environment. Now Bush is giving them a green light to make sure environment does not count.
Stay with us.
This week for our Lawyers You'll Like series, we talk with attorney Rhonda Copeland, professor of law at CUNY Law School out in Queens and the director of the school's International Human Rights Law Clinic. Rhonda was one of the few women law students in law school some 40 years ago, part of that second wave of feminism when women broke through. They're now about half the population of any law school class. And after she graduated, she really led some major legal fights, starting with the pre-Roe versus Wade abortion battles and coming up through the Harlem 6 case. So, Rhonda Copeland, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
We're so happy to see you. We wanted to talk not just about some of your significant cases, but about your development as a movement radical lawyer, some personal questions as well. Start us out and give us some reflections on how you got to be where you are today.
Well, who was it who said recently that their bio is not typical of what they're doing right now?
Probably a lot of people.
I don't think my bio is totally typical. For example, and I don't know if this will be meaningful to the whole audience, but I didn't grow up in a politically left family. I wasn't a red or pink diaper baby. But I grew up with some sense that I wanted to make a difference for social justice, not quite knowing what that was. And I went to law school, and that was a radicalizing experience. You know, the Black Panther trial was occurring in New Haven, and the war in Vietnam, and we stopped classes. And, you know, I wasn't so much involved in the 68 stuff, but it was 70. That was a big year. And then I came out, and Michael and I actually clerked together for different judges in the district court here. And I went to a meeting, the first meeting of a group that became the National Women in the Law Conference. It was a smallish meeting at NYU, and Nancy Stearns was there, who was then a very young staff attorney at CCR, as was Katie Rohrbach, who was a longtime, really amazing, you know, our sort of mentor generation feminist guild, National Lawyers Guild lawyer. And there was something about that conversation and Nancy's quality in that conversation that drew me to find out about the Center for Constitutional Rights. The other thing that led me...
You were clerking at the time,
right? I was clerking at the time. The other thing that led me to the Center for Constitutional Rights was that the judge I clerked for, who was Harold Tyler, Jr., who was a very decent, middle-of-the-road, but enormously decent, who in his later years, at the end of his life, actually resigned from the Republican Party.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
wow.
His son told me that. Wow. But he was very decent, and I walked into, and I was called by a fellow classmate who was clerking for him saying, you know, someone just said no, do you want to come in and be interviewed? And I said, well, why not? I walk into his chambers, and he had a picket sign on the top of his bookcase, and it said, why can the state force women to bear unwanted children in big red
That's
letters?
That's correct. And this is 1970.
This is 70.
Before Roe v. Wade,
before
which
Roe
was 76,
Wade.
Right?
Exactly.
Oh, Roe v. Wade was 76.
What it was, right? Was 19, it was the result. He was one of the three judges on what was then a three-judge district court reviewing the constitutionality of New York's criminal abortion law, a case which Nancy had brought before him. And that just, like, I said, I think I can clerk for this judge.
That's and, great. I didn't
and
know
we
this.
Had we had our differences, you know. We had times when we weren't talking to each other so well. And then one day we had the Harlem 6 case. And then out of that, we had the...
Our listeners may not...
And he had ruled well. I wasn't on it. He had had it. He ruled that they had a right, all of them, to talk to their lawyers together, which, believe it or not, was a big constitutional
issue. Now, Harlem 6, the famous quote, of course, is that...
Bill Kunstler was the attorney.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The famous quote is by the judge, who was a judge you later appeared in front of in the BAI case, but we can go to Judge
Culkin. Right.
Judge Culkin, who said, these defendants would know a good lawyer from a watermelon, is the famous quote.
Yeah, the watermelon judge.
Right.
We called him the watermelon judge.
And these were six blacks accused of a murder up in Harlem. Right?
And then... he had another case which involved 18-year-olds' right to vote, and he asked me to write it to recognize the 18-year-olds.
Amazing.
And I did. And then he got a lot of signals from the circuit that maybe that wasn't such a good idea, and he asked me to rewrite it.
The circuit is the appeals court that would review his decision.
Sure. And then, and I said I couldn't. Clerks are not supposed to do that.
Right.
So it was a little while until one day he said to me in chambers, and I think this is important because I think it's important to take your values into work, you know, and I think that you have to think about how you do that. And certainly I don't think I thought very too much about it. And I almost lost my relationship with the judge over it. But, you know, months later, he said to me, you know, I just got a letter from a professor about someone's applying for a job. And he said that what he really liked about this guy is that he wasn't a yes person. And he was really someone who, you know, like, you know, challenged you. And he walked in the next day and he threw me a civil rights case. And he said, you're my civil rights clerk. I didn't convince him on that case either. I did convince him while I was there. And he changed after I left. But we had a very decent relationship, and I think that those things are really kind of important. Because now that I'm older, I want to say that I learned from my students and from the things that they think that I wouldn't have thought about, right? So I think that there's an intergenerational process. So at the time I was clerking, I then applied to CCR, and I applied to the ACLU, which is where I thought I was probably going to go if I were accepted, and Michael and I both applied to Rabinowitz, Boudin, and Standard.
Right, which represented Cuba at the
and
time.
And I considered that I had no particular, there was nothing really about me that I thought CCR should have been excited about. I was drawn to CCR because I had never been in an environment where everybody was engaged in the political work that was being done.
Yeah, well, Bill Kunstler used to say the CCR represents the movement, the ACLU represents the Constitution.
That's right.
He
That's
made
right.
that difference.
And I felt that when I went in for my interview. And I thought to myself, these are not exactly my politics. You know, I was asked about, you know, how did I feel about representing bombers, which I ultimately, you know, did represent someone accused of bombing. but, you know, I was asked a lot of questions I hadn't thought about very much before. But there was something about the collectivity that I felt there that said to me, that spoke to me and just said, you know, you're going to take a step here that's going beyond what your life has been and what you've imagined for your life. But do it.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right?
Rhonda must have done great because the center had only one position, or I must have done great.
No,
we
both did great.
They had only one position and both of us.
They
wanted to go there. Both of us had actually applied to...
And you had all the credentials.
Well, both of us had applied to Rabinowitz and Boudin, and both of us in the end, I think we got offers there as well.
Getting into the CCR was part of the whole flow of the movement at the time.
Well, and we were very lucky compared to today because you don't walk out of law school and out of clerkships and walk into a job there. And we were lucky in so many ways because it was such an immensely fertile time for movement growth, right? And CCR stood out to me amongst many of the growing public interest world, and there wasn't a very big one at that point, but certain, you know, in terms of it having a commitment to women's rights as well as racial justice as well as anti-war politics.
We should talk about the women's rights, I think, a little bit, because
so
that was a struggle
that,
for you even when you came to the center.
Yeah.
In fact, someone referred to it yesterday interviewing me, Al Rubin.
Yeah.
He talked about his biography of the center,
and
he said, you know, I see he interviewed you at some point for this biography of the center. And he said there was a struggle. He said some people accused Morty of being, you know, not in favor of this. And,
oh, I'll tell you,
you know,
this.
I said, Rhonda's told me this story about how bringing in the abortion issues and women's rights issues was a struggle against what were the founders of the center, who were very political, but had some trouble understanding it. Anyway, that's
that's an exaggeration.
I don't.
Basically, Nancy Stern started the feminist work at the center and did an amazing job in terms of being the first. The case I was talking about earlier was the first case that put forward abortion as a woman's right as opposed to as a doctor's right to practice.
Well, I didn't realize
and
that.
And the picket sign came from the fact that the depositions were held at Judson Memorial. There was a lot of political activity around the case. And the depositions were held not in the courtroom, but at Judson Memorial Church. All right?
Judson, of course, as people should know, is Washington Square South.
Right.
It's the political church. It was the draft sanctuary for draft resistors, flag burners, and the others.
And it was concerned clergy, which was the group that helped women get safe abortions during that period. That was what Howard and Arlene, one of the many things Howard and Arlene were doing. So the defendants didn't like the case being in Judson Church. I think they then moved it, but Nancy knows that better than I do, to the courtroom. And when the women, whenever there was a hearing in the court, it was mobbed with women, with their babies and with coat hangers. And when women left the courtroom, they left the coat hangers.
Wow.
So it was an immensely political time. One of the next cases that CCR did with
Nancy. Today, of course, you couldn't get into a courtroom with a coat hanger.
That's right. that she did was in Connecticut. They had 1,200 plaintiffs in the case of Abilie versus Markle. We knew they didn't have standing. She knew they didn't have standing. But they were women who could get pregnant. Right.
They didn't have standing because to challenge it, you had to be pregnant according to the federal rules.
Right. Good. Michael, you're doing great here. So that was very powerful. And we played a very significant role, actually, when Roe v. Wade came up, because we were called by one of Blackmun's clerks to say, what do we do about cutoffs here?
Justice Blackmun wrote the opinion in Roe v. Wade.
This is a secret that we've kept for a long time.
So Justice Blackmun wrote the opinion, which is this extraordinary opinion, obviously. And so Rhonda...
Roe v. Wade was argued twice because they couldn't resolve it the first time, and so they argued it a second time. Blackmun was a new judge appointed by Nixon, thought to be going to be like a yes man to Berger. They were called the Minnesota Twins. And Blackmun decided to go to the Mayo Clinic and study the abortion issue. He also had a really feminist wife, right?
What year was this?
73. Well, the decision came down in 73.
In 73 it came down, that's right.
So as they were writing the opinion, the issue that came up among the judges was what was going to be the cutoff.
And what do you mean by cutoff?
The cutoff meaning they would recognize an abortion right up to a certain time, but not forever. That the state interest in protecting fetal life
couldn't have one at 9 months.
Would come in at some point. And they said, what do we do? There's an argument it should be 12 weeks. We said 12 weeks is impossible. You know, 12 weeks doesn't give women enough time. You can't deal with fetal problems. You can't deal with teenagers who don't even discover they're pregnant until they're 20 weeks pregnant. It's got to be longer. And why don't you look at Abilie versus Markle, where the judge looks at 24 weeks? And that was it. That's what became the viability cutoff line in Roe v. Wade.
That's the 6 months period.
That's the 6 months period. Nancy also developed a whole series of articles of arguments in Roe v. Wade, including that not only privacy and liberty, but equality that women have an equality right to having access to such a necessary service that only women need. And she began the development of the religious arguments, that there's a conscientious position that people have about whether or not to bring life into the world, whether they're of a particular denomination or not, and that's what the law should respect under the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution, and that the whole anti-abortion movement was premised on a religious idea that from conception you have a human soul and human person, and therefore abortion is murder. Okay, so she did amazing, groundwork for things that we then did later. In 1972, again pre-Roe v. Wade, Rockefeller, for some reason I'm trying to actually find out right now, so if anyone out there knows, please call me. I think it was a deal with the Catholic Church, put out a circular his administration put out a circular saying that we will fund medically necessary abortions, but not elective abortions. And even though every abortion is medically necessary, you're pregnant, you need some treatment, choice of treatment is fundamental to medical care, you could call every abortion medically necessary, we were frightened that that was going to bring back the old therapeutic right to life standard, and it would keep women under the rule of doctors. And one of the issues for the women's movement was our own right to decide, our own autonomy, and doctors were, some docs were great and were our supporters in the abortion rights movement, but many docs felt that they should tell women what to do about abortion, sterilization, birth control, having children, etc. So that was not acceptable, and already there was an indication from doctors that they were not going to do this. And this affected poor women. This was a Medicaid circular. It didn't affect other women because, but in 1969, New York repealed the criminal abortion law legislatively by one vote. So the case that Nancy began was mooted, and the issue then turned on poor women, because who's the scapegoat in a political battle? It's the poor women.
Who's going to pay for poor women's abortions?
Right, right, which, of course, is not a matter of money. We were asked to come into that case, and that's when we had the discussion at CCR, and that's when Morty, who I adore.
Morty Stavis is one of the founders of the center, the president of the center, and probably one of the best lawyers
that we ever
that
knew,
we ever
right?
have had. Right?
When I was in Detroit at Neighborhood Legal Services, there had been a big rebellion in the city, and the police were savage in putting it down. And Morty Stavis over in Newark had brought a lawsuit to put the police department in receivership. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And the government actually paid to fly me from Detroit to Newark to interview Morty to find out how to do it in Detroit.
Wow.
Yeah, those are the good
amazing.
Old days.
No, Morty was an amazing lawyer, and I think Michael and I often sit there and think, what would Morty do? You know, it's that kind of
all
person.
All the time. All
on
kinds
the
of
other
things
hand,
he could have
on the issue of abortion.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear you talk about.
I remember you must have been there. We had a...
I don't think I was, but I don't remember.
Where were you at that
time? No, you know, I took on and off at the center. Right. I taught sometimes. Right. I did other things.
Well, we had a staff meeting. We used to have staff meetings every week and decide on what cases we were going to bring. And we had the volunteer lawyers were Morty, Arthur Kinoy, Bill Kunstler was often there, but not always. And
Peter Weiss, probably.
Peter Weiss. And Morty said something to the effect of, haven't we done enough on this issue?
It's referring to the abortion issue.
Right, right. Because he could see that CCR, and we did, we built a program around these issues, sterilization abuse, abortion, poor women's access, etc. And it was early. It was 72. It was a time when people, when the government repression in the most traditional sense, not involving women, except if they were treated the same way men are treated by government repression, was still uppermost in people's minds. And that certainly has lasted a long time and is still prevalent in many places. And so he said, well, haven't we done enough on this? And, you know, that was a terrible thing to say. And Arthur came to the rescue because Arthur, more than anybody,
Arthur Kinoy
had the capacity to see the vision of others in a very keen way. And so in some ways, Arthur was the one. And I think it had to do with it. He was very small. But he had the ability to identify very broadly with different movements. And he said, no, 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 we have to do this. Right? And, of course, we were arguing we had to do this, and we did it. And that was the case called Klein versus Nassau County Medical Services.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, that was the first Medicaid abortion case in the country because we were the only – we were one of three states that had legal abortion at the time. And we had – and that case was a real predicate to the big abortion Medicaid case I did later, which was Harris v. McRae. But that was a case that was brought in the Eastern District of New York and involved the Nassau County Medical Center, which both was worried about funding but also was religiously influenced, who said we can't provide these abortions for the poor women. The case was before a devoutly Catholic judge, John Dooling. in the Eastern District. Did
sure,
you know John
I litigated
Dooling?
In front of Dooling.
Did you?
Oh,
what'd
yeah.
you do?
I don't remember, Rhonda, but a
well,
number of cases.
You know, Morty and Arthur used to talk about being before Judge Wisdom, who is the really progressive anti-racist judge on the Fifth Circuit.
He had the best name of all judges,
exactly.
Minor Wisdom.
Minor Wisdom. Right. Well, it might have been
Learned Hand
major,
is pretty good.
Major Wisdom might have been better.
He was out of the New Orleans courts.
But so. He was, you know, they would talk about the way, what it felt like to be in a courtroom where the judge was on your side and you right. understood implicitly, you know, that you were on the same wavelength. And Judge Dooling and I were on the same wavelength.
Amazing.
All the way through. And because he was a Vatican II, and this is how you have to be careful about labels. He was a Vatican II Catholic. When one of his clerks said to him, Judge, is there anything that is malum in se, but not malum prohibitum? The Latin words meaning, is there anything that's inherently evil, but cannot be regulated? And he said, without a moment's thought, abortion. And what he wrote about abortion, because in his view it was wrong, it was a sin, but he wrote that it was a matter of such extreme conscience. He wrote the most beautiful words
wow.
about
so
the right
of conscience. Even though it was a sin, he said the state had no right to regulate
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Wow. That it was totally impermissible to regulate it, and he wrote that with an eloquence that continues to ring today. The other thing about him that I would say is he was a very sensitive man, and some of the arguments that they would make is, you know, well, elective abortion is like plastic surgery. Well, absurd, right?
Yeah, really.
But I remember one day he sat and he would put his head on his hand and he said, well, I don't know. You know, if somebody really doesn't feel like they can go out to work because of the way their face looks, maybe plastic surgery isn't elective. I mean, you know, he was a thinker out of the box, put it that way. He didn't, every case he decided was not the best, but he was phenomenal on this
case. So how did he decide this case?
He decided that it was illegal.
To?
He decided that you couldn't distinguish that abortions were always medically necessary because within the framework of the Medicaid program, because when you're pregnant, you need some kind of treatment, and it's either abortion or pregnancy, and it's a woman's option. And it was before the Constitution. So he said the first time around, so he said it was illegal under the federal statute. And the first time around, he said, and maybe there's even a constitutional issue. Well, of course, we had to come back to him when we had to deal you know, frontally with the constitutional issue when the Hyde Amendment came along.
The Hyde Amendment banned Medicaid abortions.
Yeah, except where the continuation of the pregnancy would endanger the life of the woman. So it even excludes if the woman would be endangered because of illegal abortion, right, or self-abortion. When Congress passed the Hyde Amendment in 1976, and they did it at the time when our cases were pending in the Supreme Court, right, so they were bringing pressure on the Supreme Court. Hyde was a junior congressman, right? And this was his shtick, right? And people forget that. He pushed this as a rider on the appropriations bill. And people, you know, the Congress caved to it, right? Thinking that the Supreme Court was going to bail them out.
Your case in the Supreme Court, the McRae case.
Yeah, that was right. The McRae case. So then when we were sitting around, the whole group of us lawyers that were starting the McRae case, we were saying, where should we go? And some people said, let's go to the Southern District. There's good judges in the Southern District. I said, let's go back to Judge Dooling. He's already done it. You know, he's not going to back off of where he's been. So he gave us an injunction immediately. We went from a TRO. He says, are you ready to argue the preliminary
injunction? Against enforcement of the Hyde Amendment.
Yeah. And we went right to the preliminary injunction against enforcement. He wrote again another set of really, really beautiful language about how it would be unforgivable.
So how did you make out on the McRae case?
Well, this is what happened. The injunction held until the Supreme Court decided the other Medicaid cases, and our injunction was up too. And the Supreme Court reversed all the injunctions. The Supreme Court ruled, affecting the state Medicaid cases on medically necessary, that the state has no obligation to pay for elective abortions because there's no obligation at all to assist people in the exercise of their rights, a doctrine that became more firmly entrenched in the DeShaney case later on, which involved a little boy who was being supposedly being supervised or being watched over by social services and who was being beaten by his father.
Right. So the point is, even if you have a constitutional right to
an
abortion,
no right to have
the state will
assistance.
Not help you
right. And
achieve
Rehnquist,
that constitutional
the former
right.
Chief Judge wrote in huge terms, ours is a negative constitution. It doesn't involve any positive obligation on the part of the state.
What was the number? What was the numbers in the court? What
five
was
to four.
It was 5-4?
So then McRae.
Which is your case. Right.
Yeah. So then what they did was they reversed for reconsideration in McRae. Now, we still had a difference. We had a life and only a life endangering exception, and the other cases were medically necessary. So we thought, the other cases were still covering medically necessary. So we thought, well, there's a space in there. And what we decided was we were going to make a totally complete record, right? A complete factual documentation of what it meant to deny medically necessary abortions that were not necessarily life-endangering or couldn't be predicted to be life-endangering early in pregnancy. What it would mean to do for that in terms of the medical and the social, particularly medical impact, the health impacts on women. And we did that. And then we brought in the Women's Division of the United Methodist Church and challenged the Hyde Amendment on First Amendment grounds as a violation of free exercise clause and
free exercise of religion
and a violation of the Establishment Clause, which requires separation of church and state. Right? That was an extremely volatile part of the case. It was huge. What the judge did was, in the beginning, he said...
The judge at Dooling.
Dooling.
Who's a Catholic
we're back
judge,
before
meanwhile.
Dooling again. And
the argument is essentially is that this is a Catholic doctrine.
Exactly. Catholic doctrine. The Catholic Church was the one that was building the Right to Life movements all over the country. The money came from the coffers of, from passing the hat in the church. On Sundays in many places, we had people sending us amazing material, and we had an amazing set of witnesses. And you could see the judge becoming more and more concerned. We also had an intervener who claimed to be representing the fetuses and Henry Hyde, who was a crazy, anti-abortion, right-wing person. And then we wrote about 600 pages of briefs. And then the judge took another about 13 months to write a 600-page decision in which he gave us findings of fact on everything we needed for both the medical argument and the religious argument. And he ruled that the health issue should predominate. He ruled in our favor, and he ruled on the religious issues that it was a matter of conscience. He punted on the Establishment Clause argument, though he had recognized all the factual findings we needed to go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reversed 5-4.
And you argued that case.
I argued the case. There's a big team of lawyers, though. I was not the only one doing this. I argued the case. The Supreme Court reversed 5-4. There was a rumor that Justice White changed his vote after the conference, and I've been tracking that down. I read some Blackmun papers. That was an incredibly devastating result, right? I took the decision when I got it back to, just to close this story, back to Judge Dooling, to his chambers, and I said, they ruled against you and against us. And he had tears in his eyes, and he said, how could they do this to poor women?
Wow,
I was
story.
Right
I didn't know
in
this story,
crime.
Yeah.
And 1 year later, on the anniversary of his decision, he died at the bus stop on January 15th, 1980, because he was a person who wouldn't let them get him a chauffeur and a car, and he took the bus to work.
It's a beautiful story.
It's an amazing story.
Well, this is going to be our first cycle of interviewing Rhonda. And I think in our next cycle, I want to talk a little bit more about this, because where we are today,
right.
With what I consider to be, when I was at the center, and even today, the most important case you probably ever argued. And the loss being probably really the beginning of the end for the recognition of poor people's rights as well as just
exactly.
As poor women.
And I would say the other thing is that that was the moment in 1978 when the right wing of the Catholic Church and the Protestant fundamentalists got together in this country for the first time over abortion and gay rights. And so we documented that religious convergence, which we're now suffering from in immense.
Rhonda Copeland, thank you very much. Again, our appreciation.
Well, I love that we can do this. Thank
you. It's wonderful, Rhonda. I'm sorry.
Perfect.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Proposed by the California legislature would allow insurance companies to install black boxes on vehicles that track mileage, but also measure more sensitive information, such as how aggressively you drive. Proponents say the bill is structured so that insurance companies can encourage people to drive less with lower insurance. Consumer watchdogs say drivers shouldn't have to choose between fair insurance rates and protecting their privacy when there are less intrusive ways to collect data. Under the proposed bill, titled AB 2800, the black box would allow insurance companies to track how fast drivers accelerate, where motorists go, and which neighborhoods they drive through. The device would also monitor whether they come to a full stop at a stop sign and when they apply their brakes. Privacy protection groups are also watching as similar proposals are being introduced in other states. Today, we talk more about this bill with Carmen Balbar, consumer advocate with ConsumerWatchdog.org. Welcome, Carmen, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Carmen, this is pretty shocking. What's this black box all about?
The black box that insurance companies want to place in drivers' cars would allow them to track drivers' mileage as well as when, where, and how often they're driving. We think it's a serious invasion of driver privacy and raises some concerns about fair insurance rates for drivers who are required to place this black box in their car or pay a higher insurance rate if they refuse.
And everybody would be required to put this in their car, correct?
Well, it depends on the company, I think. Some companies are currently offering it to some policyholders and others aren't joining the program. The key there, though, is although in those circumstances, if the black box is optional, then the people who don't choose to use it are paying for the discounts that those people with the black box receive.
Can you just tell us, what does the black box actually do? If I have one in my car, what does it tell the insurance company about what my habits are, what I do? Does it tell me about neighborhoods? What is it?
Well, there are a lot of possibilities because obviously technology can do a lot of things these days. There's two answers to that question. One is, what are insurance companies already doing? Progressive Insurance is selling an insurance policy in five states that places this kind of black box technology in people's cars. They're tracking your mileage, what day you drive, what time of day you drive, and what they call how aggressively you drive. And that includes things like hard starts and stops, as they define it. Now, we have some serious problems with a lot of that information, not perhaps your mileage, but for instance, Progressive finds that people who drive between midnight and 4 a.m. are driving at the riskiest time of day, and they're going to pay more because of it. What do you say to the late shift worker, the nurse, the janitor, the radio show host who has an early morning show and has to drive in? That's their daily commute. I don't think that they should be penalized for having a late working job. simply because the insurance company has decided that's a more dangerous time of day. Same thing with these hard stops and starts. We don't really know what they define as too aggressive of a driver, but I can think of a lot of circumstances when quickly slamming on my brakes is a sign that I'm a good driver. If I'm avoiding a kid or a dog in the road, that's a sign that I am paying attention rather than being a bad driver, and I shouldn't have to pay more because of it. So that's what's already happening in some states. There's a lot more possibilities out there, and I think the big concern that a lot of people have is location. Isn't my insurance company going to start following where I drive and perhaps penalizing me and my insurance rates because of it?
Can you talk a little bit more about that? That's very interesting. Does that mean in lower socioeconomic neighborhoods that you're going to be charged more insurance?
It's an absolute possibility, and this issue is an issue that has been a constant battle with the insurance industry. Insurance companies in most states, and in my state of California, we're something of an exception, but in most states, insurance companies are already charging people more because of the zip code they drive in. Well, if black box technology is able to also track the places where people drive, then there's a whole new possibility for insurance companies to discriminate against people based on who they are. They can choose to redline certain lower income or minority communities and avoid selling insurance there or charge the people there more. Now, why would an insurance company want a red line? I don't think it's necessarily involving race or income. It's the simple fact that insurance companies make more money when they sell insurance policies to better off consumers. If they are selling auto insurance to a person who has three cars and a second home, they're going to make more money off that person than the lower income person who has one car and low coverage. So the ability of this black box technology to track this kind of where you drive information is really concerning to us. And we know that the insurance industry is interested in using a lot more information than simply the zip code we drive in. Back in 2005, the industry did a study. They released a study that said essentially where you live also has an impact on your insurance rates, but not just the zip code, but what's in your neighborhood. So they said that, for instance, drivers who live within a mile of a church are safer than drivers who live within a mile of a restaurant. Well, that's a completely arbitrary notion, and what it does is simply allows insurance companies to split out urban and rural drivers, for instance. That's the kind of use of this black box technology that we're really concerned about.
Now, what happens with this technology? Is it have to be something that the legislature does, or insurance companies just can do whatever they want on this issue?
Well, it depends on the state that you live in. Some states have stronger protections than others. Progressive insurance companies already selling this in five states: Michigan, Minnesota, Oregon, New Jersey, and Alabama. Here in my state of California, the insurance industry can't use these things like time of day or the neighborhood you drive in yet because we have a strong consumer protection law that prohibits unfair rates. The rules are going to be different in every state, so insurance companies are going to have to lobby, as they're doing here in California, to change those rules in some of the more protective locations.
How are the insurance companies selling this as a benefit?
Well, it's very interesting. This has all been tied in marketing campaigns to how far you drive. And it makes sense to people. It makes sense to me that if my car is parked in my driveway, then I'm not going to hit anyone. So your miles driven is actually a very logical way to set your insurance rates. The problem comes in when you add in all of this other information. And the industry is using, number one, that mileage idea to kind of sneak tracking this other information in. They're also painting it as an environmental move, saying that if you drive less, you're polluting less, and that's a good thing. And that perhaps if you don't accelerate too quickly and don't slam on your brakes, you're also polluting less. They're painting it with an environmental brush to get around some of the serious privacy and fairness concerns.
Can you tell me again, just sort of explain how they make more money from this process? Because, you know, their excuses are, well, shouldn't people who drive less pay less, or doesn't it help the environment? And really, in terms of thinking about those, the way I think one of the answers is, well, this is really a scheme to make more money. It's really not about those. And can you explain how they make more money off this program?
Well, I think the best way to think about it is that the insurance industry is obviously out to make a profit in any transaction with the consumer. They will consistently make more money, and they know they will, from consumers that they can sell multi-policy discounts to. So if you are a consumer who will not only insure your two cars, but your home and your motorboat with an insurance company, they're going to make a lot more money off of you than if you're a consumer with one older car that doesn't cost that much to insure. So one way that insurance companies can use this kind of information to make more money and to exclude those less desirable customers is by tracking things like your location. They can use that to make sort of socioeconomic decisions about how wealthy you are and how wealthy you aren't, and change their marketing strategies to target those people who are going to make them more money. I think the second way, simply by weeding out those people who they would consider riskier drivers. They say that the 12 a.m. to 4 a.m. time of day is the most dangerous time to drive. Well, who's more likely to be driving during those hours? But probably people with lower income jobs. Another way to kind of weed out less profitable consumers.
Let me ask you about how you see this as fitting into broader issues of surveillance. I mean, many of us have called our country a surveillance state with video cameras everywhere. I mean, do you see this as part of that broader picture?
Absolutely, and I think that's really where the red flags start flashing for a lot of people. It's one thing to think about how an insurance company could use this information to unfairly set your insurance premiums. It's a whole other question when you think about the vulnerability of that information and who else might be trying to access it. There was a big news story this month about a identity theft ring that was the largest indicted in the history of the country that had stolen 41 million credit card and debit card numbers. The way they did it was by hacking into retail stores' wireless networks. This kind of driving information, location information, time of day information is all going to be transmitted electronically, wirelessly, to your insurance company. There are no provisions for security or privacy protections in any of the incarnations we've seen thus far, and I think it raises serious concerns about who could illegally access that information, and even who could the insurance industry be selling it to. We all know that information is being used in ever-widening ways. Corporations are sharing information with marketers, employers are accessing information, health insurers are accessing information, and I think drivers should have a choice whether or not to allow insurers to track every minute detail of their driving habits and where they go because of those other considerations.
As an aside, our producer was a victim of the identity theft ring that you just mentioned.
Really?
Yeah.
This issue is becoming more and more a topic of discussion as, obviously, technology becomes more and more capable of tracking information about individuals. These are the things that need to be considered. Progressive, for instance, in the program that they run, says they can modify the terms of their program at any time, that they retain the information that they collect indefinitely, that, of course, they would have to provide it to law enforcement or in a civil court proceeding if required by law, if they're subpoenaed, and that they may try to use the information to, for instance, adjudicate a claim that you file with them. There's a broad, there's huge possibilities, misuse of this information, and we think that no consumer is fully aware of those possibilities yet.
One of the red flags that goes up for me immediately upon hearing about this is use of this information in criminal or pseudo-criminal investigation. We've been tracking here on Law and Disorder over the last several years FBI misusing their powers to spy on individuals simply because there's something that they don't like about this person, perhaps their religion. What worries me is how this information tracking your every move can be used.
Absolutely, and I think the insurance industry has made it very clear if they are collecting this information, there's no way they can deny a court subpoena. We know information from, for instance, toll bridges or toll roads, the fast track transponders, has been subpoenaed both by law enforcement and in civil cases, like divorce cases.
Divorce cases is what those easy pass, we call them here,
exactly.
Because it tells you where your husband or wife went.
What worries me is how they're going to use this. Could someone be criminally liable or this evidence be used against someone in a criminal court? Even if it, you know, they're not the driver, they're the owner of the car, but it's presumed that they're driving.
Absolutely. And what will, for instance, the FBI attempt to extrapolate from the neighborhoods you drive through? Are they going to shoehorn this into some of their anti-terrorist investigations and say, oh, now we're going to subpoena from insurance companies information about people who drive in neighborhoods that have more than two mosques within a mile radius. Who knows? There are uncountable scenarios that we can think of where this kind of information can be misused. We think that all of those possibilities need to be discussed and disclosed with consumers before insurance companies are allowed to start tracking this information at will.
And Carmen, what can listeners do if they're concerned about this?
Well, we have information on our website about the legislation that is currently here in California, which is at consumerwatchdog.org. They can send a fax to their state senators urging them to protect their privacy and simply learn more about the issue on the website as well.
Carmen Balbar, consumer advocate with consumerwatchdog.org. We'll link that information on our website, lawanddisorder.org. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Carmen. You're great. Currently, under the Endangered Species Act, federal agencies are required to consult with federal wildlife experts to make sure activities such as mining, logging, and road construction do not threaten endangered species. Now, in what of course we could all expect, the Bush administration has proposed a new plan that will give federal agencies the decision of whether they want expert consultation to determine if activities will affect endangered species. Thousands of these consultations happen each year, and federal wildlife experts have finally tuned their knowledge of protecting endangered species in the last 20 years. Critics say the proposal is a disturbing reversal and could end many of the restrictions on these agencies. Today we speak with environmental lawyer Joel Kupferman, who is with the National Lawyers Guild. Joel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
The Bush administration is playing around with the Endangered Species Act again.
Again is the right word, and it's what they call a minor change or rules change is basically decimating the whole Endangered Species Act.
Tell us what's happening.
Up until now, the law required, it was passed in 1972, that any type of federal activity, the building of a dam, building of a highway, a railroad, required that all these federal agencies seek a biological opinion from the Fish and Wildlife Service to make sure that none of the endangered or threatened species would be affected by federal construction or federal activity.
Where do they get that from? What's it called?
They get the opinion from the Fish and Wildlife Service. They have well-versed, well-trained wildlife biologists.
Scientific experts on whether this particular species or whatever else is endangered, I guess.
Correct.
Is that an environmental impact statement?
Well, it's similar to an environmental impact statement, but specifically to see if endangered species are involved.
And that system up until now has been working, I presume, reasonably well.
Most of the time it has been working, although even with the federal agencies trying to stay away or not enforce the other regulations, it has been working to the point where at least the public has been told that there's problems, and the public many times have intervened, include a whole slew of environmental groups that have sued the Fish and Wildlife Service and the agencies, including the EPA, to uphold the law and protect them.
Let me see if we can give an example. If you're going to build the federal government, if they're going to build a dam, right, or something,
right.
And whatever agency in the federal government is going to build it, in the old days, before this new proposed regulation, they would have to say, we're going to build the dam, it's going to block a river, and then they would have to go to the Fish and Wildlife Service and say, give us an assessment of what's going to happen to the fish, what's going to happen to the ecology of the farms nearby, et cetera. On the new system, what would happen? Let's say
the agency itself is self-policing, self-certifying. So you have all these engineers who were their life's dream was to build dams, right. And then now they got their dam job or whatever, right? And now full speed ahead. And we've learned in cases that we've done locally and federally that without proper assessment, without just pressure from the outside, let alone within the government. The always announcement that there's no impact.
Joel, I'm not sure I understand. So the person or the entity that is proposing to build the dam or the construction project, they are then responsible for going out and getting an independent evaluation, or they themselves can provide
They have to do their own scientific evaluation. In addition to that, they're supposed to go to the Fish and Wildlife Service.
And Bush is proposing that engineers do it scientific and
or their own scientists. And the problem is that their own scientists working for their own agency are a little fearful of speaking out. There's a tendency not to speak out against your own employer. And so some of the checks and balances have been working, at least it's in other agencies whose mandate is to protect these endangered species. So, and there's many, many scientists that have come out, the Union of Concerned Scientists, representing a lot of scientists that were told to shut up. You know, they're not allowed to speak. And unfortunately, recent laws don't allow whistleblowers to speak without impunity anymore.
Have there been any other attacks on environmental laws and regulations like this?
Oh, yeah. Right here in New York, I think most New Yorkers are aware of the failure of the EPA to come in and tell us that things are bad. We were involved with a lawsuit against Christy Todd Whitman, the former administrator of the EPA, that a few days after 9/11 happened, she came in and said, you know, the air is okay.
It's hysterical that she actually was the former head of the EPA, because I remember when she was governor of New Jersey, she was an environmental disaster.
Right. What's scary now is that she's the head of an organization that's promoting nuke power as the answer to global warming.
Let me go back for a second to the fish and wildlife thing. In this new regulation that Bush is proposing, give us what's going to happen. They proposed the new regulation. When does it go into effect with regard to an agency really, quote, self-policing itself?
There's a 90-day rulemaking period that people have the ability to comment. And even now, they're restricted. You can't send an email to the agency. You have to go to a special website to record your message. So they're actually constricting public input. And once that passes, and this is just a rule, okay? Once that passes, then the agencies, it's, it probably takes effect 90 days or 100 days there, or soon thereafter. Then federal agencies that prior to the passage of this law would have to go to Fish and Wildlife, they on their own determine whether there's any threat to endangered species or not.
Now, what is the reason the Department of Interior says for this new regulation of so-called self-policing?
It's more efficient. It's basically efficiency, and it's going to make government work smoother.
And has there been any opposition other than from environmentalists like you or others? Have there been any congressional opposition or people saying this is just a way of really allowing our environment to be taken over by, you know, economic interests, essentially?
There's been a substantial amount of congressional opposition.
And is there any chance? What's our chances here?
There's a good chance that it might, you know, be held back. But the whole idea is that we might have to wait until there's a change in administration to bring back the old rules, to bring back better legislation.
So tell us, what's at risk?
In the last, I don't know how many hundred days, or a few hundred days, this administration, that you're going to see unmitigated construction projects going out there.
By private and public, right?
By private and public, to try to get, to slip underneath the law.
Maybe entities that have been denied in the past can reassess and go forward with construction projects that were previously denied for environmental impact.
Well, there's a whole list now, and part of the problem, especially with the price of oil that's up, we've been getting calls at the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project that there's oil exploration and gas exploration that's going on upstate in places that were never touched before. And now, even if there's endangered species, they can be able to go ahead and do deleterious drilling.
So it's a free-for-all for this last period of time.
There's been a free-for-all going on, but it's been somewhat controlled. Now it's going to be free-for-all, and basically they're allowed to take off their boxing gloves.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an assault on the environment, but I do agree with you that this period, particularly the excuse of high prices of oil, is just allowing them to just sweep the table clean of regulation, I think.
Right, especially it's also done in the name of energy independence, so right. We're quite fearful.
So what can people do if they're concerned about this?
They can actually go onto the NRDC website, and there's a spot there to file their complaint, and that will be forwarded to the Fish and Wildlife Service.
NRDC stands for?
National Resource Defense Council.
And the website must be
nrdc.org, and right. I'm sure they'll have, you know, the link to that site.
We'll link to it on lawanddisorder.org if you go to our website.
Okay. Or you can come onto the National Lawyers Guild Environmental Justice website when you get, in some ways, even the more progressive view on this whole issue.
Well, that's good.
It's www.nlg.org/EJC, Environmental Justice Committee.
Joel Kupferman with the National Lawyers Guild, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Joel.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.